Now, today I want to do two things. First of all, I want to complete a message that I began last week. And then secondly, I want to give you an opportunity for some questions, and I will seek to answer them as I am able. Last week, I began to speak to you on the subject, seven deadly work sins of Christians, or if I were the devil. Bear in mind, he's out to get you. And he's a master of you, because he studies you. And he's very subtle in his approach. He slips up on your blind side. And the older I am in the faith, the more impressed I am with the subtlety of Satan. We started with four sins, and I'd like to add three more. Let's take a moment to review for those who were not here. The first problem is the problem of self-depreciation. A tendency to dump on oneself, and therefore to do the work of the devil. He's the accuser of the brethren, and he really doesn't need your help. He's very competent. I think the highest mark of spiritual maturity is a proper appraisal of oneself, to know exactly what are your assets and to know exactly what are your liabilities and your limitations. The second area in which he strikes is in the area of hypersensitivity. You can tell the quality of an individual by what it takes to stop him. And most people are absolutely paralyzed, immobilized by criticism, particularly from their peers. And I gave you a suggestion to ask two questions concerning any criticism you receive. Number one, is it right? If it is, profit from it. Is it wrong? Then don't stoop to entertain it. A third area of weakness is resentment of authority. Submission is the lifestyle of the Christian. And most of us, by natural birth, are independents. Christians are interdependents. The fourth one with which we ended was lack of self-discipline. And I am convinced this is where we separate the men from the boys, the ladies from the girls. Your ability to control yourself. And if there's any area of your life over which you do not have control, then you need the filling of the Holy Spirit. And that's a very searching area, because you are not living in a society that is characterized by discipline. There's nothing in your culture that will help you here. And I think one of the great tragedies that I face consistently is the tragedy of young people who come out of homes where they were sold down the river, where they were never taught what it means to control oneself, to forego immediate pleasure in order to get an ultimate goal. And it thrills me no end to see a group of kids on this glen who at least mentally, and I hope spiritually and emotionally, are committed to developing some guts. Because believe me, you are going to need it in the generation to which you are ministering. And to see guys and gals running out on that track out there and working out on that rock gang and serving tables and ministering in the office behind the scene where there's no glory, no glamour, nobody gives you a hand, nobody goes over to you and says, man, this is the most significant work in this generation. See, and unless you've got real discipline and perspective, you're going to fade in the stretch. We'll talk more about this in a moment. Now, number five. Try this one on for size. Inability to relate to people. There are many Christians who would be fantastic in their ministry if they never had to work with people. They are gifted at kicking people in the teeth. They don't know their friends from their enemy. And their friendships are incredibly superficial. They cannot develop close, intimate, open, personal relationships. And they develop what we call an avoidance reaction. If you are uncomfortable with people, what you tend to do is to remove yourself from people. The more you remove yourself from people, the more scared you become of people, and the more you beat a strategic retreat. Now, many of us love humanity. We hate people. I have students who love to preach. They just hate the people to whom they preach. Don't look so pious. Or many of you love to teach. Man, if they give you an assignment to go down here to teach in the Last Methodist, boy, you jump at it. And then they drop you into a class of enthusiastic juniors, you know, who got three tigers in their tank, climbing the walls. Couldn't care less about all your pearls. You love to teach. The question is, do you love juniors? Love to share Jesus Christ as long as the person responds. But what if they turn and say to you, my friend, I couldn't care less about Jesus Christ. And you can take all of that spiritual jazz and hang it on your beak. Then what do? Well, give them a portion of your mind that you really can't afford to lose. Do you blow your cork, run back to the Christian community and say, would you pray for us, a witness this week, and it was persecuted for Jesus, for righteousness' sake? No, it probably was for stupidity's sake. Let's face it. Very few Christians I find who are very comfortable around non-Christians. Who are not all uptight over the smoke and the cocktail glass and all of the rest of the anesthesia they're into to deaden the pain of an empty light. Now I want to give you the other side of the coin because you need this. People are exhausting. They are debilitating. They will whip it out of you. When I was a young man in college, I worked on a road gang. We used to work 10, sometimes 12 hours a day at hard labor. And I used to come back to this little apartment the two of us guys had, and there were many a night when I'd walk in that door, fall across that bed from sheer exhaustion, and never wake up till the next morning when the alarm went off, because we always set it in the morning to make sure it would go up. And it was the greatest thing that ever happened. Try preaching. Try teaching for 2-3 hours a day. And you'll think you've been drawn through a keyhole. It is conservatively estimated by many studies that 1 hour of preaching or teaching or direct exposure to people is equivalent to about 8 hours of hard physical labor. And this is why it's very important for you to keep a perspective, particularly some of you younger people who are very person-oriented. And you're very idealistic. And you think, man, what I really want to do is a flow into the life of people. And I say, great, man. But I got news for you. If you spend all of your time around people, you're going to be dead. And furthermore, when you minister to people, you will have nothing to give them. You've got to get away from people. And there are times when I get to the place with my intensive love for people where I think I will scream if I meet another person. And the only way I can ever get away is to go up in that room and lock that door and hide. But if I walk down that stairs, somebody says, hey, you don't mind if I ask you a question, do you? If I take a walk around the glen, if somebody's going to hit me up, the moment I sit down at a table, you can almost feel it. It starts. And that's wonderful. That's what I'm here for. But you can't do that day in and day out. And many times after I'm out in the ministry, I go home and crash. My wife is not with me. I say, wife, talk to me. I'm so tired of hearing myself talk. Tell me something, dear. Don't ask me a thing. And by the way, that's how people get professional. That's how they become clinical. You never grow weary in the work of Christ. I tell you, after 30 years of ministry, you never grow weary of it. I only regret that I have one life to give to Jesus Christ. But you often grow weary in the work. And that's the problem. And the people who get the short end of the stick are the most important people in your life. Your wife, your husband, your children, your father, your mother, your brothers and sisters. See, here you are, great big Joe Cooley in the spiritual realm, spending the summer up at the Glen. You know, but what kind of a ministry do you have to your brothers and sisters? When's the last time you threw your arms around your father and said, hey, Dad, I never knew how stupid I was until I came to Jesus Christ. And all of a sudden it's come into focus how much you've done for me. Man, I love you. I can still remember the first time I did this. I had my father out on a pier on a little lake in East Texas. And I threw my arms around him and I said, Dad, I am eternally grateful to you. You constitute the greatest asset I have in the ministry. You've taught me more than any other person on earth. Well, you have to know my father to appreciate this. He was so embarrassed. He blushed. He didn't know whether to spit or wind his watch. And as far as I'm concerned, I really couldn't care less about your ministry outside of your family. Isn't that amazing? I've just been at it too long. You can function very successfully, even in the evangelical community in the flesh. You'll never function successfully in your home, apart from the Spirit, who delivers you from yourself. So that you're free to flow into the light of other people. And don't neglect that ministry. Because someday it will dawn on you why it is that you really aren't hacking it out here on a college campus or out there on a military base or out there in a mission field or wherever it is God calls you. You know, it just doesn't have the cutting edge. And then it will dawn on you, you really don't have any kind of a ministry at home. Which gives you the leverage. I ran into a guy some time ago who tried to impress me that he hadn't sinned for the last 18 years. I said to him, do you mean to tell me that Jesus Christ had a rival in you for 18 years? Well, he hadn't thought that one through. I said, you know, I'd like to spend 5 minutes with your wife and 5 minutes with your kids. You're a man of God, you're a woman of God, let me ask your mother. Let me ask your brothers and sisters. Let me ask those that you know, see you up close. Then I'll find out if you are a man of God, a woman of God. Now this calls for seeing people through the eyes of Jesus Christ. My Bible says that when Jesus saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion on them. What do people do to you? They bother you? Or they challenge you? Many studies have been done through the years to show that a staff in any organization is its most critical public relations agency. Now, I've been here almost 2 weeks, plus the week with a staff conference, and I picked up some very interesting confirmation. The number one conversation at our tables consistently involves you. It does not involve those of us who are speaking. It does not involve all of the things that we tend to think are so important. My wife and I sat at the table a couple of days ago, and the whole conversation revolved around the serving spirit of the staff. Little incidents like hearing guys sing, you know, working out on a job someplace, or overhearing them talk about spiritual things. Or the fact that this dear girl has poured tea, you know, till it's coming out her ears. And she's got to smile again because it's another group of exciting people. One guy, an executive with a corporation, said, "I would give my right arm if I could hire people of this caliber." Where in the world do you find it? Wife and I drove up to Lost Valley Ranch to see our friend Bob Foster, his wife Marion, and also some other friends who were staying there over the weekend. Now, I was down by the tennis courts, and they had finished a couple sets, and this medical doctor came over. I met him. Delightful pagan from Austin, Texas. And so I engage him in conversation. I'm fascinated by the field of medicine, so we struck up quite a conversation. So you enjoying the week? He said, out of sight. He said, you know, I can't figure this place out. But he said, there's something distinctive about these kids that work here. He said, in all of my life, I have never found a collection of individuals. He said, would you believe it? They give me the impression they're here for one thing, and that's me and my family. He said, would you believe it? This gal took my little girl out for 2 hours on a horseback ride because I got a bad back and I can't go horseback ride. And when she came back from the trip, she said, you want to go again? And this guy kept pouring it out. You know, I just drew it out of him. Really? So, well, what do you think is the secret of this outfit? That kind of fascinates me. I just dropped in here. It's just beautiful. I was up there last year, the year before, I forget which. I sat at a table with a psychiatrist who was chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Cincinnati Medical School. I said, how come you came here? He said, friend, I just had to get away. He said, my closest associate committed suicide. We committed 2 of our staff members to a mental institution. And he said, frankly, I was beginning to come unglued. And he said, I came up here. And he said, this is the greatest therapy I have ever been introduced to. And I said, what do you think constitutes the dynamic of this therapy? I'm in counseling. I'm fascinated by it. He said, I don't know. I said, I guess somebody would call it a spiritual element. Now, he said, I know that's a dirty word for a psychiatrist to say. This guy came to faith about 3 days later. This guy is so turned on. I met him recently in a ministry in Indiana, where he drove just to spend some time with me, to tell me what God is doing in the life of his family, in the life of the ministry he sustains. This is it. Sixth, unwillingness to rest and relax. You see, your greatest asset becomes your greatest liability. And most of us have a lot of drive, we've got a lot of ambition, we've got a lot of dedication to Jesus Christ, and that's good. Our problem is that we become compulsive. We become workaholics. And we develop an inordinate view of our life and ministry. You know, I had a funeral a few months ago. That's quite an experience, you know that? Did you ever go to a funeral where your closest friend passed away, and man, it seems to you as if the whole world's caving in on you. And after the service, you know, you're in a little procession driving down the city, and in our community, cars stop, pull over to the side, and the little group of cars with the hearse passes by, and then back again. You know, I couldn't help but think, here's my friend who was very much alive a couple days ago. Really a goer, a mover, dead, body up in that box a few cars ahead. And here we are gone, paying our respects, but life is going on, just like it was before he passed off. That's a good thing for you to know. See, if you drop dead today, believe me, we'll have a memorial service. But life will go on very much the same before you passed off the scene. That's a good thing to run through your little being, because it puts you in proper perspective. Most of us have inherited a great deal positive from the Puritans, and we've inherited a great deal that's negative. One of the greatest negatives is the Puritans taught work is good, play is bad. Modern man comes along and says play is good, work is bad. The truth of the matter is both of them are wrong. Both play and work are good. And if you play when you play and work when you work, you're liable to become a genius. Most of us are playing when we should be working, and we're working when we should be playing. And play, my friend, is not wasted time. I spoke one day with a couple who were having some extreme marital difficulties. They were connected with the Navigators. And finally, I sent this guy out because I wanted to ask this wife some very pointed personal questions. And I did. And her resentment level, which I sensed before, reached a new peak. She said, I know, it's the Lord, it's family, it's ministry. But in actuality, it's ministry, 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 and more ministry. You know, I sort of got the impression she was hostile. And not without reason. One of the questions I often ask a woman is, does your husband ever take you out for dinner? Oh, yeah, but I wish he wouldn't. I said, why? He's not there. Said, you mean he just gives you money? Oh, no. He's sitting across the table, but... Do you ever talk to a person who looks slightly over your head? Does that grab you the same way it does me? I have the strongest urge to grab a guy. So we can talk eyeball to eyeball. That's what we call presence. That means that when you are with a person or when you are with a thing, you give yourself 100% to that person, to that activity. Christ said to his disciples, come ye apart and rest a while. And my friend, if you don't come apart, you're going to come apart. Because all work and no play not only makes Jack a dull boy, it may make him a dead one. And we've killed some fine Christian workers. Some of the finest. People who've forgotten that they have a body and a mind as well as a soul and a spirit. And there is as much hope for your body as there is for your soul. Your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. Don't prostitute it. I was going out for a week of meetings at a church pastored by one of my former students. And I got off the plane. He said, "Prof, let me go get your bags." I said, "Fine." And I could tell his wife wanted to get me aside. She got me in a corner. She said, "Prof, would you do me a favor?" I said, "If I can, I will." She said, "Will you talk to my husband?" She said, "He's killing himself. He's burning the candle at both ends and all along the middle." She said, "He's now down to 4 hours of sleep a night. And frankly, we can't live with him. He's going to wipe these kids out, to say nothing of our marriage." I said, "Well, I'll see what I can do." So about Thursday of that week, we were driving down the freeway and I got my choice opportunity. I said to him, "Hey man, how come you don't smoke?" "Don't smoke." We just about drove off the freeway. "Sprouf, I've never smoked." "Oh," I said, "that's interesting." I said, "I've been here all week and I've noticed you haven't lit up and I wondered why." He said, "Prof, my body is the temple of the Holy Spirit." I said, "Wonderful. Is that also why you're averaging 4 hours of sleep a night?" See, that's the kind of sloppy thinking that we slip into. Three things I'd like to recommend to you for your sanity as a saint. And even saints lose their sanity. Number one, proper food. My daughter, among other areas of expertise, is a nutritionist. And she ran a study some time ago on about 15 selected couples from the seminary. And you know what she discovered? She discovered that their nutritional level was lower than in the ghetto in Dallas. And some of you can identify with this. They eat packaged foods. They eat Coke. You know, stuff that's got this tremendous punch to it. And one of the things that you ought to do, girls, if you're going to marry a guy, and by the way, I tell guys, if you want to marry a woman, you want to marry a navigator-trained woman. They are super. But we got a supply and demand problem. Understand there's a surplus of supply here and there's a tragic need down there. So if God calls you to minister in Dallas, come see me. And I hope one of the things that you gals will do is to make sure you serve your husband nutritional meals. A well-balanced diet. It's amazing the difference this has in your ministry. One of the things that I am most grateful to my wife for is that from the earliest days of our marriage, and I mean when we were having a hard time keeping body and soul together, we always had a balanced diet. And it showed up in my own health, it's shown up in my children. And the interesting thing, by the way, is this is the only sin that you can get by with in the Christian communities. You can't drink. They'll wipe you out on that one, usually. They're fudging now. You can't smoke, usually. That, you know... See, we've even, you know, the American Medical Society came along and bailed us out on that. They said it's bad news. Yeah, amen. We've been saying that for years, you know. All you can do is eat like a pig. And there is a sin of gluttony, and it's very clearly spoken against in the scriptures. But you can go to Christian organizations, and man, you will come out looking like the gospel blimp. Well, I can tell that's too convicting, so let's move on to a second one. That's exercise. And by the way, don't get off on some jag that you've got to go this way. You don't have to go this way. There are 100 ways to go. Man, you get a little program that takes you about 7 minutes a day that will keep you in excellent shape. Do something you enjoy. Do something that's compatible with you. Do something that is in line with your own physical needs and limitations. The point is, get yourself an exercise program. I happen to believe you're too important to the body of Christ. And I believe if we could get everybody in this room on a good exercise program, we could add from 5 to 10 years to your life. Now, you talk about a ministry of multiplication. Try that on for size in terms of taking a number of people and multiplying it by adding 5 to 10 years. And you've got a significant addition to your ministry. Third, rest. Now, again, I don't mean sacking out. I have a very close friend of mine who is into sleep research for a medical school. And he tells me that too much sleep is worse than not enough. And that furthermore, there is quite a disparity in terms of the needs that people have for sleep. Some people can function on very little and function very well. I used to get so shook up about the fact that I slept so little, and I finally went to see him and got a battery of tests. He said, Anders, you don't need to sleep any more than you're sleeping. And there are other people who need more. There are some people who sleep a little, but they take little cat naps here and there. There are other people who know how to relax and who can stretch out, you know, either on a chair or on a divan and just let all of the muscles go. And 5 to 10 minutes later, man, they're ready to roll again. There are all kinds of features related to this. But the key, he said, is this. It's change of pace. So that whatever you do normally, if you want to rest, if you want to relax, change your pace. Do something drastically different. So when I relax, I don't read. I spend all of my time reading. I do physical work. I do gardening. I mow the lawns. I take walks, etc. And I believe that if you move into these three areas, food, exercise, and rest, you are going to discover that you greatly enrich just your living. And most of us aren't living. We're just existing. Seventh and last, lack of courage. Now, I'm not talking about bravery. I'm talking about courage. That's different. I sometimes think it's easier to die than it is to live. To live courageously. James chapter 1 and verse 12. James says, blessed is the man who endures testing, for when he is approved, he shall receive a crown of life. The word endure means to hold up courageously under fire. And that's why God brings problems into your life. You know what I wish I could play for you? Particularly you young people, I wish I could play for you a tape that you are going to make 30 years from now. Right now. You see, people come to the Glen, for example. It's happened so many years, you can almost write the script. You know, they come with stars in their eyes. Man, going out to that area, it's our training program. Man, it's really going to do it. And they get here, you know, they're here a couple weeks, and this is where it's going to happen. Oh, I wonder when it'll happen. You know, does it come this week? And the truth of the matter is, it's already happening. And it's usually happening about this time on the calendar, isn't it? Because this is a time when you are tempted to throw in the towel. I can tell you're so excited. So how you doing? Oh, great, I'm doing well. I got 3 weeks to go. You have to take this by faith, but I used to run track. This was back before the earth's crust hardened. I used to run the low hurdles, which is par for the course. And I went to Wheaties College. And there was a man there by the name of Gil Dodds, who was then the world's indoor mile champion, and he used to come out to work out at our track. And Gil and I developed a very close friendship. And one day he came along, slapped me on the bottom, and said, "Come on, Allie, let's go around." Great. So we took off. And, you know, I found myself 4 or 5 paces in front of him. And I thought to myself, you know, good night. Going to be the world's indoor mile champion, you know. You got to do better than that. What I didn't understand is that he was planning to go around again. And I really didn't have that in mind at all. I was giving it everything I got. And boy, we got around to the end of the first lap, and he slapped me on the bottom and said, "Come on, we got like 3 more laps to go." Well, I thought my insides were going to spill out. They'd put up a monument. Hendrix died here. And I learned there was a vast difference between running cross country and running a couple hundred yards. Most of us would be fantastic Christians if the Christian life were a 100-yard dash. But it isn't. It's cross country. When you run cross country, you need to develop the second wind. You need to develop a resistance to throwing in the towel, sort of a bulldog tenacity to hang in there. That's why God has given you problems, even here on the Glen. They are the chisel that God uses to shape your soul. C.S. Lewis put it graphically when he said, "They're God's megaphone to get your attention." So stop asking God, "Why did you allow this to happen to me?" And start asking him, "What are you trying to teach me?" I worked under 5 different men as an associate pastor. I worked under one guy. I will never forget him. Every time I put my head over sea level, he'd club me. We get a program that was going well, that's our program. We get a program that fell flat on its face, what happened to your program, Hendricks? And I can still remember one dear brother I went to see, and he said, "Allie, my greatest suggestion is that you hang in there, because far more important than God ministering through you is that he minister to you." And I'm sure many of you are looking down the road asking, "Lord, I want a determinative. I want an impactful ministry for Jesus Christ." Then the curriculum is already being designed. It's being molded right now in what's happening. Now, a couple questions and answers. We don't have much time left. What time is this over, Bob? 8. All right. Got the grand total of 1 turned in. So if you'd like to ask some questions or jot them down, I had a question and answer session not long ago. Paper came in and said, "I would ask this question in public, but my problem is sitting next to me." This one says, "If people do not know we have committed sins against them, is it right to go to them to ask forgiveness? Or is it better to confess these sins to God only for his forgiveness? In other words, if they do not know that they were sinned against, would it be a good thing to tell them, especially the unsaved?" I would say, generally speaking, it would not. In every case of this type, it's very important that you get the leading of God. Whenever God tells you to do anything, you do it. No matter whether it makes sense or no matter whether other Christians would advise it, etc., etc. But generally speaking, I think you create a greater problem than you solve when you go to people and confess sins that, to be perfectly honest, they don't even have a clue they were involved in. Now, if that became surfaced at a later date, either because of some other complicating factor or because they came to faith and recognized what was happening, then I think your obligation is different. Any other questions?
Talk about that
Yeah, I mean that criticism, you know, is like a yapping dog at your ankles. And the best thing to do, you know, with one of these little ferocious terriers, you know, that long, is just to keep right on going. And he barks himself out. He has no bite, usually. So he's got a rather substantial bark. And I found the same thing is true with people. So you're going to be damned if you do and damned if you don't. One of the occupational hazards of being in the ministry is that you're going to be criticized. If you're not criticized, you're probably not doing anything. See, the moment you start doing something for God, there are all kinds of people that have 27 reasons why that's not the way to do it. And I find, see, if you allow yourself to be poured into this thing, you just get bent out of shape. Because these people think you should, and these people think you shouldn't, you know, and here you are. You know, Joe schizophrenic. And I've got to find, Lord, what do you want me to do?
So I'd like to ask you, what part do you think an individual has in determining the sort of significance of their contribution or the impact of their life?
What part they have? I think they have a rather substantial part. But I also think that it is not apart from exposure to other believers. For example, I had a student some time ago who told me he has the gift of teaching. I said, wonderful. Truth of the matter is, I can't find anybody who recognizes that he has that gift. And if I felt that I had the gift of teaching, and over again, I get no feedback from spirit-filled believers who recognize I have that gift, there's a good possibility I really don't have that gift. It's probably what I would like to do, but it's not necessarily the thing for which I am gifted. And one of the great weaknesses in the body is that we do not have enough older Christians sustaining this ministry. And it's why over and over again I spend a lot of time just putting my arm around a guy or sitting down with a gal and say, hey, let me tell you the way I see it. I think God has given you some ministries of which you may not even be aware. Let me tell you some feedback I've got. Because it tends to be a confirming, developing thing. And on the final analysis, I got to make the decisions. Because I'm the one responsible to God. But I don't ignore the counsel, particularly of older, spirit-filled Christians.
What would be one of the most important things in relating to people?
One of the most important things in relating to people is to flow into their life and become interested in the things that interest them. For example, most people are very poor conversationalists for one simple reason. They never ask questions. So when I get on a plane and sit down next to a guy and want to engage him in conversation, I just ask him, what do you do? This guy's in the oil business. Really? You drilling? Yeah, got a rig out there. I've often wondered, how in the world do you do this? You know, here we are, boy. From here to Dallas, we're going to be talking about it. Guy sent me his book, That Fascinating Oil Business. Pays to ask questions. Seriously, I don't think I said three things from Colorado Springs to Dallas one time riding with this guy. We got up, he said, man, this was a fascinating time. He said, we're going to have to get together. And we spent some time together and hopefully got a witness in for Jesus Christ. But I think this is the key to marriage. My primary task is to be a specialist on one woman. Her name is Jean. And I study her morning, noon, and night. I can tell you exactly what she likes. What really turns her on. Where her heart is. What she's hassling. What her dreams are. Because I've got my fingerprints all over the inside of that woman's soul. You know, I got there. She taught me. It's beautiful. That's why you need a wife. You got one? Get one.